Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
New activation and upfront payment for 3-month plan required. Taxes and fees extra. Additional restrictions apply. See mintmobile.com for full terms.
Hey, sweetie, what do you think of our new car from Carvana?
Think it can handle our busy family?
Well, we have 7 days to see. First, we can take the scenic route to the beach and stargaze through the moonroof. We'll see if your drums fit in the trunk. Then we can pick up mommy's friends and check out that legroom. And we should really visit grandma. She's getting up there.
That's like a whole lifetime in 7 days.
And like one busy family.
With our 7-day money-back guarantee, you can confidently shop for cars 100% online. Visit Carvana.com for all terms and conditions. We'll drive you happy. At Carvana.
Hello and welcome to a brand new season of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. We've had a bit of a break, and sadly, one of us isn't returning, at least not in a full-time capacity. You can probably guess who that is. JM, unfortunately, is taking a step back from things, but he will not be forgotten, and nor will his fame-hungry cats, who I think managed to meow their way into every episode last season. And, of course, his portrait still hangs up on the wall at the tool shed. So, you never know, he may well join us again this season. But with JM departing, I was conscious of the fact that it was now just me. And listening to me talk for half an hour wouldn't be a fun experience for anyone. So I've changed things up, and there are quite a few changes. So let me list them. Number one, episodes are now every 2 weeks, coming out on the 14th and 28th of the month. Two, each episode will cover at least 3 subjects, and to help me cover those subjects, this is number 3. I'll be bringing in special guests like historians, folklorists, book bloggers, scientists, literary agents, and many more. Number 4, each episode will have a community shout-out section. So if you want me to spread the word of any of your writing successes, you've got a new book out, you've got a short story published in a magazine, you've finished your first draft of your novel, email me at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com and I'll give you a little plug. And speaking of community, I'm inviting you to join my own writing community. We have at the moment a Facebook group and a Discord server with nearly 200 passionate writers. So if you'd like to join us, click on the link in the description and get chatting and working together. It's great. And last of all, there are going to be video clips of the episodes now. So head over to YouTube and you can watch clips of us all chatting. It is over Zoom, but it's better than nothing. And the aim of all of these changes is to make this podcast the most helpful, interesting, and entertaining it can possibly be. There are a lot of changes, and I'm going to keep on developing this podcast if you are enjoying it. And you can help me do that by sharing it with your friends and family, following and subscribing to the show on Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, and all the rest. Leave us a review, which is so, so important, because that entices other people to check it out. And if you wanted to go a step further, you can pledge your undying fealty to the Toolshed on Patreon. We've now set this up and you can actually get some pretty cool stuff on it. I will, of course, be adding more and more over the weeks and months as well. So enough with the pleasantries. I think it's time to get down to some writing business. And in today's episode, we're covering a range of subjects. Number one, mythologies and folklore and how they have influenced the fantasy genre. We're going to be looking at how to edit a novel, and we're also going to be looking at medieval diseases, all in a neat hour. And we're going to kick things off with a bit of mythology and folklore and the influence, like I said, this has had on the fantasy genre. And to help me do that, I'm delighted to welcome folklorist Janina Arndt and Lucy Atkinson from the Fae Fellows podcast. Hello and welcome to a part of the show. A new part of the show where we look at the inspiration behind the fantasy genre, its foundations essentially, and that is folklore and mythologies. And to help me do this, I'm thrilled to welcome two very knowledgeable guests. Yanina Arndt and Lucy Atkinson from the fantastic Fae Fellows podcast. So if you like ghost stories, dragon myths, fairy folk, anything like that, go and check out their show. It's on Spotify. It's fantastic. I listen all the time. So Yanina and Lucy, welcome to the tour shed. How are you both doing today?
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
It's great to be working with you both because you've come from this where you've got keen insights in this particular area. And I think it's important to understand the foundations of the genre and where it came from. Because, I don't know, it's the kind of stories that we like, the sort of the weird, the mysterious, the sort of classic folklore. So in this first sort of installment, because Yanina and Lucy will be joining us for a few episodes talking about all different topics. But today we're going to look at the influence that folklore and myths have had on developing the fantasy genre and storytelling as a whole. So why do you want to dive in and give us a bit of sort of a background on how the fantasy genre spawned out of the tales that we love to hear around campfires and whatnot?
But you're good on Tolkien, aren't you, Yanina? So I'll throw that one to you. You're better on Tolkien than I am.
Perhaps, yeah. So, I mean, you know, we've got fantasy before Tolkien and Lewis and the Inklings, which was their sort of Oxford writing club, where we've got actually a few writers who are not that popular anymore. But, well, I mean, I think they made it very popular to incorporate, well, both Anglo-Saxon mythology, Germanic mythology, and well, all sorts of different sort of folk tales around into their history of their worlds. I mean, with Lewis in particular, we'll probably leave him out a bit more because the main focus is that, well, you know, you could say Christian mythology, but in terms of Tolkien, so. The interesting thing about him is that he, well, obviously he was a scholar of Old English and famously thought that Shakespeare was too modern to teach at university. So, you know, you sort of get the sense that anything that wasn't, you know, anything that was past, you know, sort of 800 AD was a bit too modern. So... I think we find a lot of things from very different mythologies there. And one of the aims was to give, well, Britain some kind of mythology again, because he felt like there was a lack of known folk tales, which is sort of Lucy's and my job to bring back now in our podcast. Yeah. Because there are quite a lot of folk tales, actually, but they're not as well known as, say, you know, the Grimm's fairy tales. Yeah. And there's this big story of how he went to Germany and was envious of all the tales of the Black Forest and all the worms everywhere, as in the dragons. So the Germanic dragons are usually worms. They're not the fire-breathing, four-legged and winged creatures. Yeah. They're big serpents that usually breathe acid or poison of some kind rather than fire, actually. So we've got like a lot of sort of misconceptions of what was around in that time and what influenced people. But yeah, and then on the other hand, we've got creatures like the Ents, like moving living trees, which, you know, is sort of reminiscent of tree spirits and, like, you know, not only pagan beliefs, but also we've got the dryads from Greek mythology who were tree nymphs who lived in the trees. And so, yeah, you can see an amalgamation of different European myths in Middle Earth. You've got the dwarves, which are recurring creatures in all sorts of, like, you know, Germanic mythology is not very distinct from Norse mythology. There, you know, you've got very much equivalents, like in Roman and Greek myth, with just different names. There's he takes it from all sorts.
Yeah, and I suppose, I don't know, what's relevant at the moment is something that I read not long ago is Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. That's like an old English poem, isn't it? Which Tolkien translated. Yeah. And these kind of stories, I suppose, feed into, well, what Tolkien started to write. It's like this heroic coming of age, sort of defying the odds characters, fighting all these different kind of monsters.
Yeah, there's Beowulf, of course, as well, which is really important to Tolkien. Like, he translated it as well. I read that, very difficult to read, honestly.
I know, yeah. It
is, his translation is not the most palatable, but I'm presuming it's the closest.
Seamus Heaney's is the best one. Seamus Heaney's is the best Beowulf translation.
Oh, then I didn't even know Seamus Heaney had done one, so I'll have to check that out.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so Lucy, have you got anything to add then about how sort of folk stories have influenced fantasy?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the beginning, obviously, there was Tolkien took a lot from different bits of fantasy that was like lesser known. But even now, things like The Witcher, which is, you know, one of my favorite of the newer than Tolkien, at least, takes in a lot of like, truthfully well-known folk stories. A lot of the Grimm's tales come up in The Witcher again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And all that idea of like the child surprise and the kind of almost fae rules of folklore, the way that something can be, some riddle can be answered wrong and then change you the whole life, course of your life. Yeah. I think that comes up a lot in fantasy.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. The chosen one.
Yeah, I suppose you start straying into the sort of the things that we're used to seeing, aren't we? Like the sort of mysterious but wise old wizard. Like, I suppose that these all come from folk tales.
Yeah, pretty much. Well,
yeah, I think a lot of the archetypes do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting. I never really stopped to think about where they actually came from. It's just these kind of things that have been recycled and rehashed over time. So are there any examples of like the sort of the cliches that we see, like the chosen one or the sort of the old mentor figure?
I think with old mentor figures, we've got a lot of mentor figures in folklore that are not, you know, the trusty old wizard, not the sort of Dumbledore figure, but more like also sort of dangerous in a way, and you don't quite, you know, the sibyls, and you don't quite trust them, and if you disobey them, then, you know, it's not going to go well, is it? So quite a lot of the advice and things that we see in folk tales are from you know, often, you know, we've not just got the old crone, we've also got high councils that, like, you know, like oracles that are still revered but at the same time feared. And I think that's very much the sort of vibe that we get from those who know more than you know, the protagonist of the story. I think Lucy can tell you a bit more about witches.
I can. Witches is my area of expertise. They do take an interesting route through folklore and history, witches. They kind of go from, there's a period of time where there's like two kinds of witches. There's like the good green, like folk knowledge, medicine type witch. And then there's like the malevolent, evil, bad, usually stepmother type witch.
Yeah.
And it depends on, and sometimes in folklore, the foil kind of lies in which witch you trust, whether you trust the right kind of witch or the wrong kind of witch. And it's only really when we get into kind of the real push on Christianity that kind of melts away into just the bad witch. And I think fantasy is great because it brings back the good witch that was forgotten. The good witch comes back sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's, as the genre develops, you've got to break away from what we're used to seeing, aren't we? And I think if I had the choice between reading a story now about an evil witch or a good witch or a misunderstood witch, I'd definitely go for the latter. Because you're not used to seeing, are you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you got any good examples of how of fantasy writers who have integrated mythologies in, like, other than Tolkien into their stories?
I mean, I grew up on, this is a children's fantasy, but I grew up on the Percy Jackson stories and the kind of the Riordan thing, which was all about myth, really centered in myth. At its very core. I learned a lot of Greek mythology, rightly or wrongly, from what he told me. So that's kind of the basis of my knowledge now, which is probably not a good thing. But it was always interesting. It was an interesting way to kind of live those myths, I think.
Yeah.
What Absolutely. About you, A thing that I came across this week that I remembered is actually how Frankenstein is centered around Prometheus, really. Yeah. It is in the title, or a modern Prometheus, which most people obviously, you know, who would keep that in mind. But I was going through Greek myth a little bit again, and I was like, well, yeah, that's one prominent example. I mean, you know, whether you want to call that fantasy or not, but it's at the very beginning of a speculative genre, at least, shall we say. Yeah. And so, you know, it's one example of a very allegorical kind of adaptation of it rather than a direct one.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, Prometheus is the one who gives humanity fire and is punished for it. So, yeah, in that same sense, Frankenstein is punished for his creation. I mean, Prometheus also creates humanity apart from giving them the breath of life. But that isn't what he's punished for, because he is tasked to create humanity by Zeus. And Zeus says, do not give them fire or they might, you know, they might rise up against us. And Prometheus thinks for a long time, and then he is of the opinion that it's the right thing to do, no matter what happens to him. And he is very cruelly punished for it. That is very much like in that era was like a modernization of that myth into, you know, what people would have dreamed might be possible to, you know, to raise the dead back up into life as an impossible thing. Whereas for humanity, you know, back in the day, you know, when they didn't have fire, when Prometheus gave them fire, that was an impossible thing. So that's very interesting how you can see that the same wish for the impossible just prevails through the ages. It just needs to be put into a different tale to still appeal to an audience.
When you think about it, Jurassic Park responds to the exact same thing. So it keeps coming back.
Yeah.
That's a good point. It's amazing, really. All these little strands of stories just keep seeping back into our subconscious. But I was reading a book recently, which was quite interesting because it was a retelling, and it just shows of Beowulf, and it was really interesting to see someone taking tried and tested tropes or cliches and just completely spinning them. And it was called Grendel by John Gardner. I don't know if either of you have heard of it.
Yeah.
It's really cool because it's the tale of Beowulf from Grendel's perspective, and it just, I don't know, he does a brilliant job of it, and I think it was one of his best books. But it just goes to show, like, if you are trying to explore folklore or mythologies, you don't just have to do it the same way everyone else does. Like, and like you say, you've got Frankenstein, Jurassic Park, books like Grendel, which show you what you can do, the possibilities that are out there that can play around with.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a module at uni which was about historical press as well, which is how I, you know, did a bit more about Frankenstein. And it's so interesting to see how, like, people viewed the characters as well. So there were suddenly a lot more people on the creature side, so on the monster side, by the end of the 19th century. Whereas at the start, people were, you know, when it came out, the sympathy was with the doctor. And that's the swapping around the perspective on that is whether it works or not with an audience is very much shows us what people are interested in, who the sympathies lie with, who we can identify with still. And I just really find that so interesting to see where it crops up and the same tale comes back, but now suddenly we're interested in a different character or a different turn.
Yeah.
On it. Yeah.
I always wonder about Lord of the Rings from the perspective of the orcs.
Yeah. There you go.
Because what would that have been like from their perspective? I think someone told me this. There's a guy who's done this story. I think he might be Russian. But I can't remember the name of the story or whatever. But I think something like that will probably exist, knowing what we've covered in fantasy. So I think that's a really good like sort of insight into the foundations of the fantasy genre. And what we'll be doing in the subsequent segments, I suppose you call them, is looking in more detail at specific mythologies and tales of mysterious tales, folklore tales, and really sort of examining how you can utilize them like other fantasy writers have to inspire your tales. Thanks very much to Janina and to Lucy for joining us today. Where can we find out more about you two and your lovely podcast?
So, yeah, we're Fae Fellows Podcast on Facebook and Instagram and Tumblr, and just Fae Fellows on Twitter. So you should be able to find us there. We're always happy to receive ideas for future episodes. If you'd like, you can get involved. Give us comments and everything. So yeah, hope to see you there.
Nice. And the links will, as always, will be in the description too. So thanks very much, and we'll see you next time. Thank you again to Janine and Lucy for sharing their wisdom. They'll be back next episode with a look at Norse mythology, something which has become very popular over the last few years and one I personally love. So please come back for another dose of folklore and mythology next time. Now, if you've just finished a short story or you're looking to maybe get an older one reprinted, there are a few publishers that have recently issued calls for submissions. So I just wanted to make a few announcements about some opportunities that you might be interested in. Leading science fiction and fantasy publisher Clark's World now pay an incredible 12 cents a word. So these are one of the, if you haven't heard of them, one of the top publishers of science fiction and fantasy, short fiction, I think pretty much exclusively. So if you fancy testing your hands at a professional publication, you're going to be richly rewarded. SFS Stories, which you can find at sfsstories.com. They're looking for sci-fi and flash fiction stories under 1,000 words, and they pay $25 for original stories as well. So that's worth looking at. MythAxis magazine, mythaxis.co.uk is where you can find them. They're open to submissions until October the 31st. They pay $20 for stories between 1,000 and 7,500 words, though they say over 5,000 is a bit of a harder sell. Black Air Press is looking for short stories for its current feature, Dark Moments. You can find out more at their website, blackairpress.com, and just have a look at the submission guidelines. Sentinel Creatives, looking for submissions for its new anthology, Folkloric, Lovecraftian Tales of Folklore and Horror. I think if you just Google Folkloric, you'll be able to find that one. And lastly, fantasy novel publisher Feral Books are on the hunt for submissions, and they're closing their doors for a period on the 31st of October. I've met with the chaps from Feral Book, and they are very nice people, and very, as a new publisher as well, they do a lot of very cool things, and they look like they're going to go places. So well worth checking out. Plus they aim to give feedback to everybody who submits, which is incredible for publishers. So you can find out more about that at heroicbooks.com. So good luck if you do submit, and if you find success, please drop me an email at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com so that we can congratulate you. And speaking of success, I'd like to wish a big congratulations to the following authors on their recent achievements. So congratulations to Alana Gomel on the upcoming release of her hotly anticipated novella, Little Sister. More congratulations go to Paul McDermott on selling all copies of his new book, Taking the Heat, at a local market in Liverpool last week. Eleanor Dixon, congratulations on the release of her new spooky book, The Ghosts of Amber Wood. John Tarrow is having a very spooky time in his amazing fantasy house, which you can go and visit. It's called Talliston, so go and check that out. Congrats to prolific short story writer Pamela Jeffs on the upcoming release of her next collection, the Terrorlight Collection. And Lee C. Conley, a fantasy author from the UK, has slashed the price of his Norse zombie fantasy novels for Halloween. You can find out a bit more if you go on Amazon and search for A Ritual of Bone and A Ritual of Flesh. And a big well done to Mirabelle on starting work on her middle grade adventure story involving two children and their pet puppy who is rejected by their parents because he is different. Again, a big, big congratulations to everybody. I don't think people really appreciate how hard and laborious writing is. So it's so important to celebrate every achievement, big and small. And if you've got a new book out, or you've got a short story published, or you've just finished drafting a short story, a novel, or you've just started work on something that you're excited about and you want to share the news, drop me an email with the details and I will share it on the next episode. Now, we've still got crack and chat about medieval diseases and medieval life to come with Aidan Mathis from the wildly popular Lore Lodge podcast. But first, I wanted to talk to you about editing novels. Some of you may already know that as well as writing, I work as a copy editor. So pretty much all day, I just spend my time moving, removing and adding words. Some people find this a bit of a tedious task, and I know a lot of writers who don't really enjoy editing. But I'll tell you, when you've done a job where you're getting screamed at by some drunken old hag in the 13th hour of your shift, you can do a lot worse jobs. And working as an editor has taught me a few ruthless skills needed to pick apart your writing and ultimately to learn how to improve as a writer, because that's what editing sort of is. It's a critical reflection on what you've created. It's the process of assessing whether or not it works, whether it can be the best it can, and thinking of ways to make it even better. So what I wanted to talk to you about today is probably one of the toughest and laborious editing jobs you can do. Editing a novel with so many words, a long roster of characters, and such long strands of plots that weave and meld together, it can be hard to keep track of everything. And when it does come to the process of tying all those strands into neat little bows, it can be hard to know where to start and how to avoid tying yourself up in a knotted mess. Now, I've read the books of a lot of editors, a lot of very successful editors, and influential editors as well as writers who spend their time proofreading and editing. And they all, in these books, explore the processes that they go through when it comes to editing a novel or any piece of fiction. Coupled with my own experience, I wanted to share with you today my own step-by-step guide for editing a novel. And this is something that you can download too via the link in the description. So there are 10 steps in all, and I'm just going to go through them. So when you finish your draft, I always think after a day or so, undertake a bit of a reread, correcting any glaring errors which leap off the page to ensure it's completely readable. At this stage, we want to refrain from getting drawn into any sort of editing challenges that may crop up, but by all means, highlight them for later attention. And then what you want to do, this is the second step, is just set the story aside. This is a bit of advice that I learned from Stephen King, and I think it works amazingly well, because what you do is by leaving the story alone and or locking it away in a cupboard, as Stephen King put it, or a drawer, or one or the other, you basically forget about it, and then the next time you come to read it, you've got fresh eyes. You can't really remember the ins and outs, and you can see things in a lot clearer light. So the longer that you leave it, the better. To be honest, if you're quite forgetful like me, then you can put something aside for a few days and you've completely forgotten about it. So it just depends on the person, but the longer you leave it, the better. Step three, when you've had that sort of cooling off period, let's call it, go through the story once more. But this time, this is the most crucial thing. We want to attend to major matters first. And this is a piece of advice that I got from Master Editor Sol Steen. And it makes complete sense, because rather than editing line by line, you need to understand whether the key aspects of your story actually fit and work. So by this, we're talking about character, plot, theme, maybe a bit of dialogue, but that, I say that comes later. But the three components for me are character, theme, plot / conflict, because that's where the character and conflict combine to form plot. That's my theory anyway. I mean, that's what we want to focus on, because they're the three pillars of your story. Your story will be made or broken by these. And it makes sense if you think of it like this. So like fixing a car, you wouldn't start fixing the window wipers if the engine's knackered. So it's natural. It feels natural to focus on these key components first before you get stuck on making your prose more florid. Because these big tasks are usually the hardest to fix and the trickiest to fix. And I could go into loads of detail about how we go into editing different things. I will put some links in the description of this episode so that you can go off and do a bit of further reading if you're interested. But focus on the major matters first and go through, do a full edit of your story or your novels, just focusing on these points alone. Number four, now we've considered all the major matters, we want to read over it again. This time, pruning any new sections that you may have added and to develop the story. And just because when you add these things in, most of the time they're going to be in first draft form. So they're going to need a bit of attention to make them shine, to make them make sense. I'm seeing some of my drafts. So at this stage as well, you can sort of dip your toes into fixing any prose. So anything like grammar, syntax, sentence structure, adjectives and adverb use, passive voice, any instances of using the five senses, sensory descriptions to bring to life the story, to immerse the reader, any instances of telling too much instead of showing, or any opportunities to show emotional action, and also world-building details, because after all, we are writing fantasy. So by this stage, you've pretty much done a good job of editing the content of your story. You should know if it makes sense. There should be no flat parts of your story. There should be a nice stream of conflict. Characters grow, develop, whatever, however you want your story to pan out. And we've gone through it three or four times now. It should be in pretty good shape. And for me at this stage, this is where it gets difficult to do much more on your own without the insights of third parties. So this is where I like to try to send out to other people. Now, it can be hard to find people to read your work with a critical eye, because you do need to get the feedback, but you also need to get a bit of distance as well. You're sending it to your mum or your dad or your close family or friends. They're not going to give you honest feedback, and it's the honesty that's what we need. To know if it's good, if things work, where we need to go to focus our efforts a bit more. So to find these people, they're not that tricky to find. There are writers out there who are willing to do swaps. So if you read one of their stories, they'll read one of yours. That's a good way of doing things. Try joining the online writing group, our writing community. The link to join is in the description. So just join us and put a request in and you get help that way. Another option, which is number six on the list, is if you have a mailing list, you want to broaden the scope, depending on how much time you want and effort you want to invest in a story, is to broaden the scope of who you get feedback from. So if you have a mailing list or a wide network of writing friends, like a writing group, for example, ask them to read it. And the more people that read it, the better. When you send out your story, what you can do, and I have seen people do this, is send like feedback forms for people to fill in. So they can ask for the views on particular points like character, plot, theme, dialogue, any issues that the writer wanted to address with the story. And this is a great way to get like really constructive feedback. So it's up to you if you want to do that step. I think it's quite related to five. So you could combine the two or take one or leave the other. But I do think the more people that read it and the more feedback you get, ultimately the better your story will be. When it comes to listening to that feedback, one thing I will say is if everyone says different things about your story, you can kind of assess each one individually and determine whether, well, they are sort of a credible complaint or a credible piece of feedback. Because if everyone says something different, then it's more of a matter of opinion. But if everyone says the same thing, so if everyone says, oh, the character just doesn't do it for me, or the story sagged at this particular point, if more than a few people are saying that, that means there is an issue there and that you need to go and have a look at it. So they're the clear, obvious ones to fix. But when it comes to the sort of the scattergun approach to feedback, just investigate each one and then make the decision yourself. Number seven, after a few weeks, reread the story again. And this point ties in with number 7 on the list, which is to basically accumulate all this feedback. And after a few weeks, just let it percolate, let it stew. And then go through your story and read them and investigate. And again, if there's any complaints about major errors, fix them first before any of the others. And that's just make sure that you're focusing on the key components of your story as opposed to the sort of the niggly bits that don't really matter as much as the key drivers. Number 8, if you've got the time, I always like to think, leave the story another week or so and then come back to it for a final read through. The more times you do read through it, the better. But if, like me, by this point, you're probably sick to death of it, especially if it's a novel, because it does take a long time to read a novel. Number 9, now this is an optional stage, but if you can factor it into your story, it will be better for it. Send it to those readers again and ask for comments on the piece as a whole, whether the original problems were corrected well enough. This is near enough your final draft. You're basically coming to the end of the process and you just want people to hopefully tell you that you've nailed it. Lastly, number 10, make any suggested final corrections that you agree with, of course. Read over it again, if you can be bothered. And lastly, look to get it published. I think that's a nice, simple, yet comprehensive way of editing a novel, and it tackles all of the key things in a pretty structured way. But remember, there's no right way to go about editing. The only way that is right, essentially, is the way that works for you. And you may find that you simply a writer that can't advance without perfecting the previous page that you've just written. Or you may spend all your time doing draft after draft until it's spot on. And that could take years. I mean, some writers are like that. But whatever your process, if it works for you and you feel comfortable with it, then go with it. Because who's to tell you otherwise? But what I will say is try to learn as much about editing as you can before you settle on a particular approach. That's what I try and do. I try and learn as much as I can from other people all of the time. So while this approach that I've shared with you today is what I use at the moment, it'll no doubt change again in the future. And like I said before, you can download a copy of the step-by-step guide via the link in the description. And please email in at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com with your favorite bits of editing tips. And I'll share them in the next episode for the benefit of everybody else. And now I think it's time to take a trip back in time for what will be a regular feature of these episodes. A bit of history, specifically medieval history. Because this era in particular, the fantasy genre takes so much from it. So many stories, fantasy stories, are set in worlds that mirror the Middle Ages, and in particular from Europe. But we are seeing a lot of positive changes in the diversity of fantasy now, which is great to see. But if you're like me, I live obviously in the UK, and I love the windswept hills, lush rolling hills. That's my kind of forests and stuff like that. That's my kind of escape, and that's why I like this kind of stuff, and I'm sure that's why other people do, and that's why it's so popular as well. So that's why we are going to focus on the medieval, and particularly the European medieval period, because the reason why we're looking at this is if you're writing about it and setting your stories in this sort of landscape, this kind of time period, we need to know a bit about how people lived and what challenges they were faced with on a day-to-day basis, and of course how the likes of battles and wars were waged, and weapons like swords and bow and arrows were used, because that seems to be the main pastime for people in the medieval era, killing and invading. Now, some people say to me, it's the fantasy genre, you just make it all up, it doesn't matter, it doesn't have to be accurate. And yeah, you can do it that way. But if you want to give the reader a truly immersive experience, you need lovely little details to draw them deeper and deeper. And we get these details from research, and that's why we're doing this. So in each episode, we'll be examining an aspect of history, like I said, medieval history for the first few episodes. And this is all to help inspire your stories and empower you with wisdom and knowledge to utilize when you write. And in this first episode, we're taking a look at the diseases that ravaged the Middle Ages with historian Aidan Mattis from the Law Lodge podcast. Hello and welcome to one of our features of this new season of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. It's a history corner, if you will, and I am absolutely delighted to welcome to the Toolshed Aidan Mattis. Aidan, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Been a long day over here, but I'm catching up with my caffeine.
That's how we function, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So now Aidan is the host of The Law Lodge, which is a really popular podcast. And on that show, he discusses folklore, history, and all the mysterious and unexplained. I've been listening to it nonstop for like the past week, so do go over and check it out. It's on TikTok as well, I understand. And new episodes go live every week, plus a live show on Mondays, is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Sounds amazing.
Me and my co-host, who has the same name as me.
Simple. So as well as podcasting, Aidan has a degree in medieval studies, and we've just been chatting as well about your planned master's in medieval studies as well at Bangor University, which is just down the road from me in Wales. And over the next few episodes, Aidan's going to be joining me on in the Toolshed for chat about medieval history, because so often fantasy genre lends inspiration from this particular era, and it's probably because of Tolkien, let's be honest, the fact that everyone loves bows and swords. So so it's great.
Do you have a bow and a sword in this room? I do have both. I know I'm sure we'll get to it eventually, but axes, the axes and sword representation in fantasy media is so backwards. It's one of those things that really gets me, but I understand it. Sword fights are much cooler to watch than two dudes just hacking away at each other with broad axes. I get it. I understand.
So these are the kind of things we're going to be talking about over the next few episodes. And we're going to kick things off with something topical today, and that is diseases of the Middle Ages, because we haven't had enough of disease and viruses, as far as I'm concerned. If anything, the news has gone quiet on diseases and viruses, so let's bring it back up. Let's go back.
I think everyone's pretty tired of it at this point.
But we can ditch the coronavirus and look at some pretty horrific and interesting ones as well, can't we? Medieval times. But I think what when we explore diseases of the Middle Ages, well, what we're looking at is sort of touching upon the lifestyle of people and how diseases were allowed to spread and things like that. So I think one thing that springs to mind when we think of diseases of this time is the Black Death. So
absolutely,
share your wisdom.
Sure. So the Black Death specifically refers to the breed of bubonic plague that came out of Asia via the Silk Road in the mid 14th century. And this specific Black Death was not necessarily new to Europe. It wasn't that the bubonic plague had never reached Europe before and had never ravaged through and people didn't know what it was. It actually, when people first started developing the bubons, those black pustules in their arms and their chests, people had seen it before. They knew what that was. They knew that it was deadly. They knew it was a problem. And to an extent, they actually knew how to quarantine by the time that the Black Death reached Europe in, God, what was it, 1346? I think the first outbreak was. And of course, it came over, it originated somewhere in East Asia and traveled via fleas and rats over the Silk Road and then through mostly Venetian trading vessels up into Italy and then spread across Europe from there, eventually killing 33% to 50% of the European population at the time, which is absolutely astounding to think about those. And even back then, you know, obviously population numbers were a hell of a lot lower, but think about in terms of how many people, you know, COVID has killed. The Black Death killed way more in a much smaller population. So it's, you know, basically think of every third person you know dying. And that's in the places that fared better. I think it was in England, I believe, it was a full half the population that died. And it was kind of ironic because England would have probably been relatively okay if they hadn't insisted on invading France at the time. And thus bringing the Black Plague back with them. And then, of course, the very same thing happened to Scotland when the Scots decided to invade England, trying to take advantage of England's situation with the Black Plague. And then, of course, they themselves subsequently suffered from the Black Plague and lost half of their population. So it's, you know, the only people who really kind of, the only countries that came out of that period okay were kind of like Iceland, Norway, the Nordic region. But yeah, I mean, when you think about the Black Plague and also, you know, what it was and how it spread, you got to remember probably the biggest issue here is that people back then, while they understood that being near dead people could cause you to get sick and dumping waste into your drinking water could get you sick, they didn't have germ theory. They didn't get that. They didn't know that it was bacterial microbes that were crawling around and living on surfaces. So all they knew was, you know, a very basic, you know, correlation. If I go near this, this happens to me. And that made it very difficult for a society that was at the time growing massively to really deal with this. And it didn't help that for, you know, the Middle Ages was a time when obviously the Catholic Church was very powerful and religion was a very central portion of many people's lives, and a lot of priests and spiritual leaders took this as an opportunity to say, oh, well, this is God's wrath for being sinful, and if you just repent your sins, you'll be spared, which was not the case at all. You know, happy to go and have a theological argument about, you know, was the Black Death as a whole divine wrath, but you know, the exact specifications, the scientific technical details of why people were getting sick had nothing to do with sinful behavior, but rather germs.
That's hygiene.
Yeah, it's, and of course, hygiene is one of the other things that the medieval period, the reality and the media portrayal are often very different. You know, no matter what piece of media you're consuming, I shouldn't say no matter what, but most media you consume, especially nowadays with the Viking era being kind of this big fad in TV, is you see, you know, everything's muddy and people are throwing their waste out of second story windows into the streets. And, you know, there's just dead bodies in places and people are, you know, not washing or anything. And this is very much due to some 18th, 19th century authors describing the Middle Ages as a dirty time, a time that we had evolved from. This was all part of the Enlightenment era and how they were trying to portray a return to the classical era of Rome and Greece when things were clean and tidy and neat, you know, when they had communal toilet sponges in Rome, you know. Like, really not sure that we're getting quite an unbiased read of what was going on here. But yeah, people's hygiene in the Middle Ages was very much a part of what spurred things like the Black Plague. And it wasn't the Black Plague, I should just clarify really quickly, that led to a lot of these quarantining behaviors in Europe. That concept they got from leprosy, which the way that you dealt with leprosy was you took lepers and put them into lepers colonies. Because they knew that if you touched a person with leprosy, you could get leprosy. They didn't understand why. They didn't know what was going on. They just knew that leprosy was transmissible. And so if you took all the lepers and put them somewhere else, you would be safe from leprosy, theoretically.
All the bell as well. Let them know you're coming.
So, yeah, lepers walking around wearing bells. It's just like... just to... you know, get back to the Black Plague for a hot second here. You know, it's one of those things that has led to this outcropping of people believing that the Middle Ages were this time when everyone was dirty. And in reality, medieval people bathed as often as really anyone else during the same time frame. Probably once or twice a week. It was very dependent on how much water you had. So if you had a stream nearby, you were probably bathing fairly often. You're probably washing your clothes, washing your dishes and everything. If you lived in a city with less access to clean running water, you probably bathed less, which is why, when you get to things like the Palace of Versailles, which was notoriously filthy, you know, it's, that was a very particular example of a noble court that had gone way overboard with decadence and everything. And they didn't, and obviously it ended up having horrible effects for 16th, 17th century France, 18th century France, I guess. But again, what I'm saying here is basically, if you're looking at the Middle Ages and you're looking to that era for inspiration, one of the common mistakes that people tend to make in terms of, you know, being historically accurate or historically proper is that they portray everything as dirty when it really was not. The Nordic and Celtic peoples, for example, both bathed very often and cared for their hair. And there's suggestions that the Celts from ancient times would pluck all of their body hair. And then, of course, when you got into, for example, noble courts, and specifically in the Celtic world, in, you know, Wales and Ireland and Scotland, you had a custom that your hair was pretty sacred. And the only people who were allowed to touch your hair were like your family and your spouse. So if you allowed somebody to groom you, to, you know, cut or comb your hair, it was very much a symbol of accepting them as a close relation, you know, and you're imparting that you trust them symbolically. So, you know, this idea that we have of things being just as dirty as they were is definitely something that people should be aware of and people should think about when they're going and writing about this era and about, you know, things based on this era. Is was much more, if you look at Tolkien's elves, that would kind of be like the way they behave in terms of hygiene is actually a lot closer to what a lot of medieval societies did in terms of the average person. You know, the average medieval peasant was clean and aware of what caused sickness, and they were smart about it. When you got into the cities and into the courts, it was just a matter of exposure. They didn't really know as much, and they had much different focuses in life.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I mean, humans just don't like being dirty, do they, generally? Like, the Romans have houses. So, like, why would all of a sudden this entire period of time, everyone just all of a sudden, I'm all right with being dirty?
Yeah, it was much more, things like the bubonic plague specifically, leprosy was a different story, but with the bubonic plague, the biggest issue there was between the years 1000 and 1300, Europe's population quadrupled. Yeah. It went from being very rural, very agrarian, to having cities larger than the ones the Romans had, which the Romans had very, very advanced large cities with plumbing and, you know, complex architecture. And by the time you get into the 1300s, you've got Gothic architecture, you've got buildings like the Notre Dame, you've got plumbing, you've got aqueducts being rebuilt. Like, people knew what they were doing. You know, this is a period of time that we forget, in some places, was considered the Renaissance. And of course, the Renaissance is more of an arts and culture thing than it is a real time period. But it's, you know, that later medieval period, you've got cities being built up and built up and built up and getting more crowded. And it was very difficult for these urban populations in this newly revitalized urban Europe to properly dispose of dead bodies and properly quarantine themselves from the sick. And that's why, you know, with leprosy, they knew what they were doing. They were like, okay, well, we know from hundreds of years of wisdom that leprosy is contagious and you need to take lepers and quarantine them and remove them from the population. That's how you keep people safe from leprosy. When the bubonic plague got there, they were like, what is this? Like, why is everybody dying when I touch them? Like, how is this spreading? And of course, not everybody who got the bubonic plague died. It was very lethal, but it didn't kill everybody it infected. So you'd also have people walking around with these, you know, sores and these scars from the plague that, you know, people were like, well, why did they survive? And of course, nobody had a good answer. It's just natural immunity, essentially. Yeah. But people who had, or people who maybe had experienced a similar disease earlier in life. But it was not, it was the primary issue for disease in Europe was not hygiene. It was overcrowding.
Yeah. And like you say, like a massive surge in population, the sewage systems can't handle it. And like you say, there's
exactly
deaths. Like, it's just a recipe for disaster. But what I always like find interesting as well is you talk a lot about it there, is the knock-on effects. So the Black Death, the because there was no workers for the fields and stuff like that, the peasants could renegotiate better terms with themselves, couldn't they? And that led to
led to the creation of surnames in England.
Which
is crazy.
Is when peasants started getting a bit more money, they started getting a bit more fashionable. And then when laws passed that restricted what peasants could wear because the upper classes
weren't
the peasants were wearing.
There were certain instances where it got to the point where you had, and one of the other misconceptions is that, like, you had this rigid class structure where if you were born a serf, you would die a serf. Not necessarily. Serfs were tied to land, but they could amass wealth. Obviously, they had a certain tax rate they had to pay, but they were not slaves. They could amass wealth, and you could have very wealthy families that were serfs because they had no reason to not be serfs. They were still tied to the land, but they could buy their freedom. They could buy their land and they could become freemen. And if they were freemen, then, they had a lot more, ability to move throughout society. And when you get to that point and you are, a well-to-do freeman, a well-to-do peasant, and you have a little bit of extra money, you don't necessarily want to buy your way into the nobility, and maybe you don't have quite enough to buy your way into the nobility, but you've got enough to buy a nice purple cloak. Then the nobles who very much see nobility at the time as something that is conveyed through the blood, through the genetic lineage, obviously they didn't know what genes were yet, but they were close enough. They got it. They were like, all right, nobility is carried through your father's line. Which of course blood is carried through the line of the father, in terms of the actual, like, your blood is, you and your mother don't have the same blood when you're in the womb because it would kill you. So they believed that nobility was something that was carried in the blood. And, since, for example, purple was the color of royalty, that it was insulting for a peasant to be wearing a purple cloak, even if they had the same amount of money as a rather impoverished noble. Yeah. So there were instances where laws were passed that were, restricting what peasants could wear. And in some cases they would use the church to do it. They would be like, you shouldn't wear this on this day because it's immodest. And these laws would only ever affect the lower classes because they were the only people who could possibly be punished, because you gotta remember the base of what made medieval nobility elite in their status was that they were the martial class. Yeah. So, it's the church couldn't do much to them, but it could do a lot to, John Smith over in the local quarry.
Not much has changed, does it?
No. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah. Aidan, that's been a fascinating conversation there about diseases, and I hope you all learned something new as well. I learned so much there. So, Aidan, if people want to find out more about you, go to the Lore Lodge.
Yeah, check out the Lore Lodge on YouTube and Instagram, and then also Spotify. We are on Spotify now. And then I have my own set of content that is a little bit more, I guess diverse would be the word, on TikTok, and that's just the Aidan Mattis. That's just, my name. And as well as on Twitch, we do video game streams, and we also do music and just chatting and like stuff like that. We have some fun with that. So if you're interested in any of that, check us out. We have a lot of good history content uploaded on the channel now. We've got, I think we're on our sixth episode comes out this week. By the time this airs, we'll probably have a few more. It's right now we're going through some of the, We're trying to set up like a backing library of content where we've got the general history of various groups and cultures. And then as we build that library up, we're going to dive into some of the more specific instances. So people can start with the broader topics and move into the more specific, kind of the way that, a college course would be structured.
That's awesome. There you go. Don't need to go to college.
Yeah, just come watch my channel. You don't need to go to college.
Yeah,
I'm basically reading out of my college notebooks.
If you can present it well like you do, then you don't need to. Aiden's going to be back for the, like I say, next week and a couple of weeks after, and next episode, sorry, because this is every 2 weeks, not every week. So we'll be coming back with archery, because that is something that a lot of fantasy writers get wrong. And Aiden's got a lot to... Oh, Aiden can't wait.
I have a lot of thoughts.
See it in his eyes, he can't wait. So, thanks very much, and we'll see you next time. Thank you again, Aiden, for sharing your insights and wisdom. I've had so much fun chatting to Aiden for this show, and I've learned an awful lot from him so far. So I hope you find it just as beneficial and inspiring for your own writing as I have. Like we said at the end of that little part, Aiden will be back next episode with a look at archery and how we can more accurately portray it in writing. And that is about all for today. I really do hope you enjoyed this episode and learned something new, because that's what life is about, learning something new to expand our perspectives and our understanding of the world around us. So if you did enjoy the show, please share, subscribe, follow, and if you really, really loved it, please consider checking out our Patreon page. If you'd like to join our writing community too, just click the link in the description. Hopefully I'll be chatting with you on there soon. And like I said, we'll be back on the 14th of November with archery, Norse mythology, and a look at science and fantasy. So don't forget to send in your shout outs to fantasywriterstourshed@gmail.com. And until then, happy Halloween and keep on scribbling away.